This is Car Expert.
It'll still be a great car, but I know that there are a lot of enthusiasts who will not be happy that there's no manual.
Now, coming back as an EV, it's a laydown misere that this thing will sell.
Silver paddle shifters on an Eclipse Cross. It's kind of an interesting touch that's sort of lovable.
G'day, my name's Mandy Turner, and this week it's a pleasure to have Anthony Crawford on the panel. Hello.
Hey, Mandy, from we're the naughty people on the northern beaches in Sydney. Still naughty, I believe.
Yeah. Well, myself and Scott Colley is also on the panel as well. We're a bit safer down in Melbourne. Hello, Scully, by the way.
Hello, Mandy. And, Crawford, I'm sorry to hear you guys are locked down because we've done it before and it's not fun.
It's a real pain. No. The first time in my life I've actually had no family at all. And then my best friend who I went to school with in America, he was coming, lives close by, and he apparently, his son was at a hotspot in Manly, and he's now in lockdown as well because they saw him a day after or something. So from no family to no friends to just ourselves. So
you'll have the Car Expert podcast to get you through.
Yeah, exactly.
We're here for you, Scroll.
Yeah, exactly.
A review that's just gone live at carexpert.com.au is your review of the Lexus IS. How did you find that drive, Crawl?
Well, where do you start on that one? I've always let's be honest, Lexus have an infallible reputation for build quality, and that still exists, and it was there from day one with their LS400 and then 430 follow-up, and it's still there today. How does it drive? Well, to be honest, as I said in my review, and if you can read that review, it's quite a lengthy one, that all three powertrains, that's the 2.5-litre naturally aspirated hybrid, the 2-litre turbocharged motor, and the 3.5-litre V6. They're all carryovers, and they've all been around for ages. This car was launched back in 2014, had an update in 17, then for 2021. It is quite a healthy revamp, refresh. They call it reimagined. And that's not such a not such a big call, I should say. It's quite right in that it's a very different looking car. It sits lower, longer, wider at both ends. The only thing they haven't done a lot to is probably the interior, which although it does get finally after a decade, we get a touchscreen unit with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, which is a godsend, to be honest, because that trackpad and mouse pad they had before that was literally unworkable. And I don't think there's a single soul in the world, including those at Lexus, that wouldn't agree with that sentiment. But anyway, yeah. They fixed that, and it's a good screen, although it's kind of just floating there. It's not integrated in any major way. But that fixes most things these days, doesn't it? The center console has been there for, as I said, since 14, and that's exactly the same.
Is there anything that makes it feel aged, Croft?
Yeah, the center console looks, does look from the 2000s. It really does to me. The thing is, it's beautifully put together and beautifully crafted. So there's only so much negativity that I'll throw at it. It just looks dated, if I can say that. The German marks that it competes with, A4, BMW 3 Series and Mercedes-Benz C-Class, they are all, cutting. They have all got cutting-edge technology, and they keep pushing that boundary with each iteration of those cars. And Lexus hasn't really done that. Nor do they have a really high-performance version like the ISF, which they had on the second gen but failed to come good with that on the third gen. I think we're all waiting for that, or certainly Lexus fans are, to get back to a 5-litre, grunty, great-sounding engine, four exhaust tips at the back, even though they were stacked above each other like a double-barrel shotgun. Barrel over barrel. it's a good car, but these engines, they're outclassed by literally all their rivals now. They just feel lackluster to me. And
what powers it?
Well, they're 2 liter. It's a 2 liter, a 2.5 liter naturally aspirated hybrid, electric hybrid that I drove mostly. Then I did get a drive in the 2 liter turbo, which has a lot more grunt. That hybrid really is only for day to day commute, as far as I'm concerned. That's not. I mean, it does go, but you've got to rev the living, you know, bejesus out of it. Yeah, and it's very noisy. And, you know, as other CVTs are, CVT transmission, they're very noisy when you have to rev them. And they're not pleasant. Although this is probably the most refined of any CVT out there, that pairing to that engine. Then you step into the 2 liter turbo, and that's demonstrably more potent than the hybrid. And that's actually quite good. It's got paddle shifters. And that gets going. I mean, you know, as speeds we can do in this country, I'd say they're fine and adequate. The V6, which I drove back in when the second gen was released, and I had a hugely spirited drive in regional Victoria, and I loved the car then. It was just felt fast. It felt, you know, amazing. And now it feels really underdone compared to the high power 2 liter turbos that they've got, or the 2.5s. with Audi. But you know what they spent their money on with this iteration of IS was handling and dynamics, and that's where this car, you know, I would say competes very well with its competition in terms of handling and going into corners and all that stuff, and the way it rides, that's all A+ in my book.
What do you think of exterior styling? Have they done anything with this? Yeah. The imagination, as you
yeah.
say.
Yeah, particularly the F-Sport versions, which get pretty much a whole body kit. The front and rear guards are beefed out quite a lot. It's a as I said, wider front track by 45 mil up front, 50 down back. So this is a much more aggressive car. It's lower car, 18 mil at the bottom of the tapered roof line, and then 31 mil, I believe, at the boot line. So, you know, this looks great. It's always looked. The third gen was a great looking car. Don't get me wrong. This is a probably potentially a better car than some of the Euros in terms of its aggressive stance. And you kind of expect more when you get into this car, but it doesn't really deliver on terms of that performance. But you know, the body is stiffer. They've lightened the suspension components, coils and stabilizer bars. So they've done a lot to it. You know, it's a different looking car, albeit more aggressive, and, you know, the suspension has made this car a more precise handling car and certainly pointier when you turn in. So, yeah.
Why do you think they bothered? Because sedans are falling in popularity, and Lexus as a brand has got a whole lot of SUVs now. It's got the UX all the way through to the GX. Do you think that the IS still plays a big role in how people see Lexus, or do you think it was more just a project so they do have something to steal people away from the 3 Series?
Probably the latter. I did ask whether there was going to be an ISF, and you know, they were very tight-lipped. Scott Thompson, the CEO, was also very tight-lipped, and I spent some personal time with him, and he wasn't. And I know him quite well, and he wouldn't let anything go. Unfortunately, so I don't know if we're going to get an ISF. This might be the end of the run. You got to remember, the IS is the biggest selling car in gross numbers for Lexus. So I guess it wasn't something they could just let slide and drift away into the tidal wash, as it were. But they had to do something, and I think maybe this is going out with the last hurrah, to be honest, and have made their, you know, the iteration that they've got now is the best looking IS they've ever built. But they, you know, they didn't do anything with the engines. These are there's no extra performance. Kind of a shame, but you know, I don't think people buy the IS that are into, you know, performance and enthusiasts. I think it's a different buyer, one that appreciates the quality, appreciates the perceived reliability of Lexus, and you know, the way they look after you when they service your vehicle and give you a loan car and all that. And I think they've done what they had to do to satisfy the Lexus buyer, and I guess you can't blame them for that, you know.
Well, you've given it a Car Expert rating of 8, so you can check it out on the website now and join in on a lot of comments there. I'm sure, Crawf, you're enjoying reading those.
What's
as well.
What's it up to, Mandy?
65.
Oh, that's quite good. Happy with that.
Not bad. Not bad.
Happy with that.
Time for this week's car news. Now, Scully, I know how fond you are of the Subaru Liberty, and with Liberty Final Edition, not good news for customers who have ordered one, is it?
It's not. So, yeah, the Liberty was removed from the Australian lineup. Subaru announced it would remove it earlier this year after 31 years, which left a lot of people sad, me included, because my first car was a Liberty, and also the first car of my parents that I remember was a Liberty as well. But to send it off, Subaru promised this sort of sporty-looking special edition with the final edition badge inside and a whole lot of little trim tweaks. And the cars have actually started arriving in Australia, or Subaru's gotten a final confirmation of the spec of them, and it's missing some of the things that were promised. So Subaru said there was an internal error, and the final edition doesn't get things like the Harman Kardon sound system, the black interior and exterior highlights, and ultra suede interior trim with blue stitching, which seem like small things, but if you've laid down your hard-earned money for a special edition having read the spec sheet, not getting the car you were promised is pretty disappointing. Mm. Subaru has said that it will offer either a refund, free registration and CTP insurance, or a three-year service plan to customers who aren't happy with what the car will look like, and they'll sell the car to someone else once they've done that, obviously. But one of the people we spoke to sort of said, that's all well and good, but we're just disappointed that the car that we were promised isn't the car we're going to get. And to be honest, none of those options are attractive to us. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out over the longer term and how many customers who pre-ordered actually take delivery.
Yeah. How many models did you say were released for the final edition?
Only 31. So in keeping with the 31 years. So there's not too many disappointed customers at least.
Yeah, that's true. What was the price difference? Like how many extras were included in over the normal Liberty area?
So Subaru said that there was $6,400 worth of extra equipment over the 2.5i premium when it actually promised the car, and the car cost $1,990 more. There's 15 with grey finish with black wheels, 10 in black with silver wheels, and 6 in white with gunmetal grey wheels. Those 31 are meant to celebrate 153,000 Liberty sales since 1989.
Wow. So I feel like it's, what, $2,000 over-ish over the normal Liberty. And I feel like the choices they've given the customers aren't that bad, really.
No, I don't think so either.
Like registration, obviously it depends where you live, but maybe $1,000 there. Insurance would probably be $1,000.
I think Subaru, and obviously there's no way that Subaru would have done this deliberately. So, I mean, first up, it would be frustrating as a customer, but also there's no way in the world a car maker would deliberately promise you one thing and then deliberately deliver something else on the scale that Subaru has, even though there are only small spec differences. That wouldn't happen deliberately. So there's been an error internally. And, yeah, I personally think those options are pretty fair. It would absolutely be disappointing if you had put your hard-earned down for a car that you really liked the look of, and especially if you were a Liberty fan or a long-time Subaru fan. Being a part of something like the Final Edition, even though it is a spec pack, would have been quite cool. So I can understand why people don't want to give up their allocations but also don't necessarily want the car that's been optioned. It would be a frustrating bind, but, yeah, I think Subaru has been pretty fair with the options they're offering.
Sorry, can I just say that I also had a Liberty. That was our first, luxury car out of getting out of a Toyota Corona. We had a Toyota Corona.
Oh, wow.
And my daughter, we'd basically put all our money into her education. So we would go to this elite private school in Sydney's northern beaches, if you like, and we would have the best, most beautifully polished dark blue, midnight blue Corona pulling up beside Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Volvo. And I just wanted my wife to be in the best looking, most polished car there. And we finally got the money and bought a secondhand 1997 Liberty. And shock horror when I drove out following her and realized I'd put the money down on a two-wheel drive rather than the all-wheel drive that I desperately wanted. And I was feeling sick with, that sick feeling when you've made the greatest error. We only paid $23,000. I think the all-wheel drive was probably $27,000. So we bought what we could afford back then. So
did you end up telling her?
No, I don't think she realised.
I was going to say maybe she worked it out the first time she did a massive burnout away from the lights. Tony, this is wrong with this car.
No, my wife is a stickler for the speed limits. There has to be one of us.
Oh, good. Yeah. Hey, Croft, the 2022 GMC Hummer EV seems to be pretty popular. Already 10,000 pre-orders have been received.
That's just staggering. And we're a year away from the actual vehicle being released. I mean, can I just say that there's no surprise that Hummer disappeared and then came back purely as an EV platform, because I remember when Al Borz had one as a press car when they were on the nose, and I remember he called us up to say he'd just been egged, and the car, the whole car was covered in egg yolks. They were never going to come back unless they were an EV. But I tell you what, this is without doubt the real world Cybertruck. I mean, because that Cybertruck, the way it is, that Tesla Cybertruck, that's never going to happen. It would never pass safety, would never pass pedestrian safety. It's just not going to happen. And yet they keep, you know, they promoted that thing for ages to get no doubt share money in for their stock, I suppose.
Would you have a Hummer EV?
I would love a Hummer EV. It's just got the right look. It's wide. It's tough. And I believe they're getting an SUV as well. And Scully wrote the story, I believe, and GM Special Vehicles haven't said yes to it yet. But, I mean, wouldn't that be a lay-down misere for them? Want to get that vehicle, I would have thought. I mean,
I think it's definitely one they'd want to get their hands on if they could, because, I mean, for one, it's an awesome flagship product, and it's also, I think, a perception changer. I think one of the problems that GM has is that people see it as failed Holden, or, you know, the Commodore maker that's not making Commodores anymore. And the Corvette's one step to changing that, but the Hummer is going to open it up to an entirely new audience in Australia, you know, environmentally focused people. It'll also be the first all-electric ute actually on sale in Australia if it does come here, because Rivian has said the R1T is going to come eventually, potentially 2022, 23 from memory. The Ford F-150 EV isn't coming here at this stage. It's not been fully revealed yet. And the Cybertruck is the Cybertruck, and we just don't know at this stage. So GM does have an opportunity to get the jump on its rivals and really, you know, lay down a marker as an environmental leader with the Hummer EV. But I think the problem is going to be they just won't sell enough of them in Australia to justify engineering a right-hand drive, and converting an EV truck is going to be tricky for the first time. So I'm not holding my breath at this point.
No, I mean, the figures are extraordinary on that edition one, 745 kilowatts. And am I reading this right, or is it an error? 15,591 newton meters of torque?
No, I think that's a different reading, isn't it? It's
GM has published the number after it's been adjusted for the gearing in the motor,
right?
Which is not really a fair comparison. So I think I can't remember exactly what the number is converted back to a normal comparison or a normal figure, but it's more in keeping with the Cybertruck and what's been promised from the Rivian, for example.
Yeah, I mean, this looks terrific. That light bar sort of across the front of the grille looks amazing. The interior looks cool. And I love the width, and I love the what it looks like, a lot of space inside there. I've always liked the Hummer, and it's only because they became such a dirty word, really environmentally. And now, as Scully said, coming back as an EV, it's just a perfect, it's a lay down misere that this thing will sell its numbers off, won't it? I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, moving on. Just a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, actually, I think, Scully, you spoke about this, about Nismo offering a full restoration program for the Nissan R32 Skyline GTR. Well, now another Japanese make, Mazda, has jumped on board with a little bit of a difference. It's offering FC and FD RX-7 owners the chance to purchase reproduced parts. Now, Mazda has already done something a little similar, like a full restoration program on the MX-5, but it's good to see that they're looking after a different model this time. So 61 wear and tear parts will be available. The full list is at Car Expert. So it starts from something cheap as like a $1.34 washer right up to a $562 throttle sensor. The list of parts were compiled by Mazda, who actually spoke with mechanics who work on the RX-7 in Japan. So they've definitely nailed the part list on this one. They'll be available from February next year in Japan. So a great little thing for RX-7 owners.
Can I just say, Mandy, that model RX-7 was my dream car, like that. The one that won Bathurst. I don't know if that's the FC or the FD, to be honest, but or that did it win
the blue and white
on the 12-hour. Definitely, I thought. I hope I'm not wrong. But it was a revered car at Bathurst.
So, Croft, the car that won Bathurst, it was in 1994, and it was finished in BP silver, green, and yellow. It was the more recent model. So it wasn't the really angular one that you see a lot of getting around. I say you see a lot of, you see if you're getting around, it is the beautiful, curvy, I want to say Fast and Furious. I know that people aren't going to be happy about that, but that's actually my first thought of the car is Han's car in Tokyo Drift. But, yeah, it won the Group A category in the 12-hour.
Yeah, it was a hardcore car. It was really expensive. Like back in the 90s, I believe it was like 80 or 90 grand. Like it was right up there with the GTR, to be honest. It was just a great looking car. It was super low and I believe it was very stiff, beautifully set up for track use as a production car even. Anyway, that's another car I'd like to get in my garage. Yeah.
I'm just having a look to see how much they're sort of going for now. So a 1996 RX-7 Series 7, 58 grand, Croft in white.
It's not too bad, really, when you think about it.
Especially now you can get parts for it from Japan. So you're not even going to be stuck on the side of the road with a blown rotor or something like that. You're going to be able to find the bits and pieces for it. I have no idea if a blown rotor is an actual thing now I say it.
I actually remember I actually had a girlfriend. I had an Alpha Spider 2-liter at the time and she had the original RX-7, both in red, and I swapped driving with her and I don't know. I thought my Alpha felt incredibly more alive than that RX-7 back then. So, you know, maybe, you know, Italian, I don't know. I've always loved cars, you know, but I love the look of the RX-7.
Yeah. Scully, the 2021 Ioniq 5, the specs have been leaked for this car.
They have. So Ioniq is Hyundai's new electric vehicle brand. They use the badge on their hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and full electric sort of Toyota Prius rival at the moment. But the Ioniq brand will eventually be applied to a whole range of electric cars built on the really quite clever eGMP platform that Hyundai revealed earlier this month. And the Ioniq 5 is going to be the first of them. It's actually coming to Australia in the middle of 2021, and then other models will follow after that. And Hyundai Austria, not Hyundai Australia, that's not a typo, published a whole lot of figures on its website for people who wanted to pre-order the car. And so we know that it will be offered with a 58 or a 73 kilowatt hour battery pack. The smaller battery will have 450Ks of range and the bigger battery will have 550Ks of range. So those numbers put it right around a Tesla Model 3 standard range, which will do about 490 kilometers on a charge. Like Tesla, Hyundai is also going to offer dual motor all-wheel drive. So the numbers on the Hyundai Austria website and also reporting by the Korean car blog, who do a fantastic job, show that the two Ioniq motors will both have all-wheel drive with dual motors. It's going to have 230 kilowatts of power and hit 100 k's an hour in 5.2 seconds, which is pretty impressive when you consider it's actually longer – sorry, the same length and wider than a Hyundai Tucson, the new model. And it's got a bigger wheelbase as well. So this is not going to be a small car, despite what we maybe thought on the back of the 45 concept that led to it. Those are pretty good numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Why is it that Tesla, no one seems to sort of be worrying about matching their sort of 0 to 100s, which they so dearly pride themselves on?
I think it's a matter of just relevance to day-to-day driving. And what Tesla has done for electric vehicles is absolutely awesome. There's no questioning there, the leader and the innovator in that space. And one of the ways I think they started that was by doing really outrageous acceleration figures because people went, oh, that's right, electric cars don't have to be a golf cart or a milk float. They can actually really hammer. But I don't think that's the pitch for the mainstream car makers because Tesla's already done that. So if you're Hyundai, your pitch is, we've got dealerships everywhere, we can offer you good after sales, and you've heard of our brand before. And the acceleration is less relevant, I think, compared to in a Tesla.
Yeah, and a quality and build quality that's probably, you know, right up there in terms of reliability, I guess.
You would certainly think so. And I think the other thing that Hyundai has going for it, as do these other brands, is in Europe, for example, Volkswagen is offering really competitive financing on its ID.3 hatchback. Mini is doing something similar where it's almost a sort of try before you buy on the electric hatch. These big brands have got big established finance arms and more customers that are willing to finance through them. So the other thing they can do that Tesla can't is sell cars to people in a slightly different way and finance in-house on the changeover from their other car. So, yeah, I just think the acceleration is less relevant when the case for buying the car financially and the sort of comfort factor with the brand is what it is with an established company like a Hyundai.
How do they treat warranties with this sort of thing?
So most of the brands will transfer their normal warranty onto the car itself, and then most of the batteries will have an 8-year, 200,000 from memory, kilometre warranty on them. And that's for degradation to a certain level. Usually it's 85 or 80% of the original charge level because these batteries do degrade over time. But if they go wildly beyond that, then that's covered by warranty as well. Mm. But in terms of normal warranty claims, there's far less to go wrong with an electric vehicle than there is on an internal combustion vehicle because obviously there's far fewer moving parts. So I think the way we look at warranty and the way maybe brands try to pull people in with after sales is going to have to change going forward because although a warranty is nice to have, I mean, the control electronics failing would be pretty horrible and would definitely be covered, but otherwise there's far fewer little bits and pieces that are going to need covering and maybe people will change the way they view that.
And is this an 800-volt architecture in order to fast charge?
It is. So the Hyundai eGMP will do 800-volt just like the Porsche Taycan. I don't know that the whole range will have that same fast charging capability, though. So that hasn't been confirmed for the Ioniq 5, nor for the cars that will follow afterwards. I don't know if that's something that will just be switched on or reserved for the top spec cars. I'd be very surprised if Hyundai engineered this very fancy platform and only used it on some vehicles, though. But yeah, so Hyundai says on a 350-kilowatt ultra-rapid charger, you'll get 80% charge or in 18 minutes or up to 100 kilometers of range in just 5 minutes. So it really is up with the cutting edge. And that's not only because Hyundai wants to future-proof it, but it also has plans to build a sports car in this platform. It's talked about being able to do 0 to 100 in 3.5 seconds with the right motors on there. So I think along with the bottom end stuff like the Ioniq 5 that's going to be sort of mainstream premium-ish, it's going to try to offer a real competitor to some of the premium brands and really try to do a flagship electric vehicle as well.
Do we have any idea of price?
We don't at this stage. The Kona Electric is Hyundai's most expensive electric car currently and it's $65,000. I don't know where the Ioniq 5 is going to fit in relation to that, but it is a bigger car, it is a more modern car, and it does promise better numbers than the Kona. So it wouldn't surprise me if it's more expensive. I don't know how much more expensive, and that could be miles off the mark. Hyundai might really shock us like Toyota did with the GR Yaris, but purely on the numbers, it wouldn't surprise me if it's upwards of $65,000, given it is going to be quite a big, quite a premium looking and feeling car from what we understand.
Yeah, I mean, an Audi e-tron's about 130, isn't it? Like
130 to start for an e-tron. You can pay, I think, upwards of 150 for the top spec Sportback. I think the Jag I-Pace is about 120 as well, and the Merc EQC is about 130 to start. So if Hyundai can slot in between the mainstream stuff and those cars, provided the product is good enough, which on paper it is, there's definitely an opportunity there for it.
And to round out this week's news, we welcome James Wong to break some disappointing hot hatch news. Hello, J-Wo.
Hello, good to be here for the short amount of time I will be on.
Yes. The Volkswagen Golf GTI Mark 8 is coming to Australia next year, but sadly with only two pedals, it's now going to be in auto. Shall I pass the tissues around?
Yeah, well, it's funny because people have been acting like this is like this big new thing that they've done, but they actually did it with the Mark 7.5 as well. So I got one of the first lots of the 2019 build Golf GTIs, and from that point they were auto only as well. But I guess the real outrage is that there's a manual available in Europe and other parts of the world, and will also be the case with the R. But if this decision is any indication, both the GTI and the R in Mark 8 guys will not offer a manual option in Australia. But we will be getting it in about May. So it'll arrive a couple of weeks after the rest of the Mark 8 range. And it will basically have a carryover powertrain. So to my knowledge, it's pretty much the same as what my car has. So it's a 180 kilowatt and 370 newton meter 2 liter four cylinder turbocharged petrol engine. And it will drive the front wheels with a 7-speed dual clutch DSG transmission. Basically a carryover powertrain with a brand new exterior and interior. They've made revisions throughout the chassis and everything to make it lighter and drive better. And we've seen really good reviews out of Europe. So I'm sure it'll still be a great car, but I know that there are a lot of enthusiasts who will not be happy that there's no manual.
Is that just the numbers, though, telling the story? And, you know, if they had enough people that, you know, were inclined to buy the manual, they would offer the manual in this country?
Yeah. So Will Stopford wrote this story, and he reached out to Volkswagen Australia about why they decided to continue going auto only. And when they first made that decision a couple of years ago, it was because I think manual GTIs were only making up about 5% of the sales mix, which is a very small number, because GTIs and the performance models are still not the majority of Golf sales in Australia. So it was already a fraction of a fraction of sales. So, you know, you're talking, you know, maybe tens of, if maybe not 100 and something units annually. So that was why they decided to do that in the first place. And they maintained that when we questioned them about it. So I guess it's unfortunate, especially given some other rivals are offering two transmissions instead of just manual now. So we can think of, like, you know, Renault Megane RS and Hyundai i30N were previously manual only. Now they get a manual and an auto option. Same thing for the Ford Focus ST. And I think that even though manuals are probably a lower sales volume than the autos in the Australian market, despite our thirst for performance vehicles, I think most people still prefer to do autos for daily driving. Mm. I think it's a shame. But yeah, I guess we just have to deal with it.
We're also hoping, I think, that when Volkswagen does do a special edition or, you know, a performance version of the GTI, because it's done the TCR to farewell the Mark 7.5, and it's also said that I think it's called the Club Sport in Europe, which is a hotter version of the GTI. It's said that that could show a little bit what a special edition might look like in Australia. So my sort of hope is the manual comes back in a pretty limited run, and that way the people who really want one and want to track their cars but want a GTI can still get their fix, and the people who want to look good in their suits and cruise into work every day with the DSG, James Bond, can also get those.
I don't think the Club Sport comes with a manual. I'm looking at it. I'm looking at our story now. I don't think it has a manual. Even the press images, it's an auto. So if it's anything like the TCR, there's no manual option for that high. Yep, available only with a 7-speed DSG. So even for the high-performance one that's meant to be the track car, they're only doing DSG now anyway.
Your car might be worth more, JWoww.
Except he's a DSG as well.
Yeah, I got a DSG. But that's because I wanted the performance pack and the mechanical diff. So I went with that instead. But so it's basically got the same powertrain as my car, as far as I'm aware. But still, like, there's a lot of really good coverage out of Europe about it from what I've seen. Like, Top Gear was very, complimentary of it. There's a few other publications that have run very positive reviews. It seems to go pretty fast and it sounds okay, because I think they offer an optional sports exhaust in Europe. So I don't know whether we'll get that as standard equipment or whether it'll be an option. And it's got all the tech. So it'll be an interest. I really want to see one in the metal, because I'm still not quite sold on the design yet. Like, I really like the 7.5 generation. I think it was like the pinnacle of the design. I think it really honed in on what was great about the Mark 7 generation. It was like a really clean, classic design, and it still looks good now. So I'm really interested to see how this new, like, wider and lower look for the Mark 8 sort of translates on the road. I also don't like the standard wheels on the Mark 8 GTI, so it'd be interesting to see that in person. It's getting people talking, I guess. So that might be a good thing. Any coverage is good coverage.
Absolutely. Now, while you're here and we're on the topic of Golf, you've recently conducted a comparison between the Golf TCR and your very own Golf GTI. That would have been a lot of fun. Do you think you made the right decision in buying the GTI over the TCR?
Well, I didn't actually have the choice of the TCR when I bought mine, but I did consider upgrading to either a TCR or an R when they came out. But yeah, it was really interesting to drive these cars back to back. And, you know, I haven't, you know, obviously this year with getting back into journalism and driving a lot of different cars, I haven't spent as much time behind the wheel of my Golf as I would have liked, but this obviously gave me the opportunity to do so. And the TCR is an interesting car. We've covered it a little bit with a track review, and Alborz did a launch review of it as well. And it's funny how they've sort of tweaked it in all these little ways and made it a little bit firmer this here and a little bit sharper there. And, you know, it's still usable as a daily, but I think for me personally, because I'm very practically minded and in my mind, I want to use it as a daily, I still prefer the way that my car drives as a daily. But then when I took the TCR out and like really gave it a good boot, it was like, it was noticeably more grippy and, you know, hug the road better. And, you know, the sound of it is much nicer. You get like the little farts on upshifts, and it has like these little pops on overrun, which were really cool. And it looks fantastic. Like I had one in that solid gray, which is almost like an Audi Nardo gray sort of look. And it just looked really, really cool. And the what they've done with the body kit and the wheels and everything, it just looks a lot meaner. So it'll be really fun to – I haven't written it all yet, but it'll be fun to sort of go through the ins and outs of it and come to a verdict, because I know that, you know, not everybody is using these as a daily. They might buy that as a proper, like, weekend warrior sort of thing.
Do you think people will buy the TCR as a weekend warrior, though, when you can get a manual i30N, a Honda Civic Type R with one of the nicest manual shifts in the world, and also the Megane RS, which is not perfect but feels very sharp compared to a normal GTI. The GTI doesn't seem like a natural base for a track car to me when there are so many other really good focused track cars already out there.
Agreed.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think you're right. I feel like most people who are buying any performance Golf are intending to use it as a daily driver. I think that's a pretty easy thing to assume. I think that's also why they've catered for that by making it livable, because even in its firm settings and whatever, like, yes, it does ride a little bit harsher around the city. I noticed that it picked up a lot of imperfections, and quite harshly too. I hit the bum stops a few times traveling at like 40 or 50 Ks an hour in the city, just going over road joins or, you know, imperfections in the road, which was actually quite annoying. But I still think that most people will sort of buy it maybe with the intent to track it once or twice, but it's still probably going to be a daily driver, and for that purpose it still does the job and likely will be better than some of those other more focused cars that you've listed, Scott. But I still, it's definitely more focused than a GTI or normal GTI or an R in everyday use. And you really do feel the differences, especially when you drive them back to back. It's actually quite a noticeable difference.
I just wanted to say, is the Euro version quicker than the one we get on PCR?
On paper it's meant to. So there's a noticeable difference in the mechanical specifications between the Australian market car and the European market car, just for any of the listeners who didn't know that. So our market gets one that doesn't have like the petrol particulate filter and the exhaust systems that are required for European emission standards. So it also means that we get a lower torque output and a 6-speed DSG instead of the 7-speed that they have overseas. So the Australian market TCR makes 213 kilowatts like the European version, but makes 350 newton meters. Whereas the European market one actually makes 380 newton meters and uses a 7-speed. So I believe the transmission is the same as the one that's in my Golf, because my Golf is a Euro 6 certified one. And as the for the Mark 7.5 update, the GTI Performance and the R, because they've both got more than 350 newton meters, picked up the wet clutch 7-speed. Which I think is a high torque transmission that they also use in some of the diesels. And so I think the TCR picks up a version of that transmission in Europe as well. So in terms of performance specifications, we don't have a quoted top speed or anything like that for our market, because that's not really relevant, to be honest. But the Australian market car is quoted as 1/10 of a second slower from 0 to 100 than the European market one. So that's the one difference on paper officially from the manufacturer. And I would assume that if you were to take it, you know, as far as you could with a long enough space of road and no restrictions or anything, you might find that the 7-speed might go faster. I don't know, because the 6-speeder seems to have fairly short gears compared to the 7-speed.
I know, but that's a lot more torque for the Euro. It's 30 Newton meters more in the mid-range. That should count for quite a lot.
That was something really interesting between the two cars that I had to test, because my car actually makes 370 Newton meters. So my car has more torque, but the TCR has more power. So off the line and, you know, in everyday driving, the normal GTI performance feels a lot more effortless. Whereas when you're really revving it out, the TCR just has so much more pull at the higher end of the rev range. So it was a really interesting comparison because they have very different personalities.
I would have thought for TCR, it would be an opportunity to, you know, 5 millimeter lower is negligible. I mean, to be honest, I mean, most lowerings by car manufacturers are like 20 mil if you go sort of to lower a car. 5 mil is almost unrecognizable.
Well, I think that's also because the normal GTI, I think, sits 15 to 20 mil lower than a normal Golf, and then they've lowered the TCR by another 5 millimeters. So I think that's why they minimized it, because if you see it sitting there in the car park, it's sitting quite low on those wheels, and I don't think there's a whole lot of suspension travel. Even though it's got adaptive dampers, like the comfort mode was still nowhere near as comfortable as mine, but it was still a really interesting compare. And I think anyone that wants a fast Golf, and you know, the normal GTI is a bit tame, it's definitely something to consider. Though I would be really interested to know and drive back to back a normal GTI with the optional 19-inch wheels back to back with a TCR, because I think that was another element of the ride comfort that I was really appreciating about mine. I've got basically a completely standard car, no options. It's got the 18-inch wheels, so it rides really well, and it's quite refined on the open road. Whereas I think having a 19-inch wheel package on a normal GTI might have made the comparison a bit closer, I guess, in that regard. So that would probably be an interesting comparison to do as well.
Mm. Joe, I know you're still putting the comparison together, but do you know which one is sort of pointing its nose in front of the other already?
To be honest, I don't think there's going to be a clear winner overall, purely because I think that you have to look at it from two different mindsets. I think in terms of, you know, a daily driver, something that you're going to drive to work every day, and then maybe you want something a little bit sportier, I think the normal one, like I probably prefer my car, and that suits my taste, because I like to have an all-rounder that can do it all and do it in comfort and still very practical. But I know that there'll be some people that want that really focused drive, that might want to go to a track day, or they want the, you know, they go driving all the time up the hills in, you know, the Melbourne hills in the east in Victoria, or they might do it in Sydney and whatever, anywhere basically. And I think that the TCR will probably be a more engaging and focused drive, which is what some people look for. I think it really comes down to personal preference. So it'll be interesting to sort of consolidate those thoughts in the written, because there might be two or three sort of strains of thought, if that makes sense, because there's so many different scenarios and so many different reasons why people buy these cars that, you know, you've now got a different Golf for sort of every occasion, because you've got a normal GTI, you've got the TCR, which is a limited edition, but they're still on sale, and then also the R, that are all three very different cars based on the same thing. So it's a very interesting thing to sort of consider.
Yeah, plenty of choice, which is fantastic. Keep your eye on carexpert.com.au for that comparison, going live very soon. James Wong, thank you very much. Been a good chat.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hello, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy.
Now, you've recently driven the Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross. The review is now up at the website. Looks like it's had a bit of a facelift.
It has had a bit of a facelift. The Eclipse Cross kind of gets lost sometimes between the ASX small SUV and the bigger Outlander. It's Mitsubishi's in-between car. And it sort of tries to be a bit more interesting and a bit more upmarket than those other two that really do sell on price. Mitsubishi has kind of set it up with a big mission by giving it the Eclipse name. Of course, the Eclipse was applied to a sporty coupe that was sold mostly in the US in the 90s and 2000s. So when you call your car that, some performance is expected. So the company has updated it at the midlife point. It's got a new nose, that more aggressive frontal design that we've seen Mitsubishi take on recently that looks really quite good. And a very different tail. The old one had this very sort of polarizing split tailgate going on where it had a vertical light bar, sorry, a horizontal light bar running all the way across and a real kind of bobtailed look about it. This one's 140 mils longer, which actually makes it the same length as a Mazda CX-5, so sort of differentiating it a bit further from that ASX. And the one that I drove was called the Aspire, priced at $36,490 on the road. So it kind of competes with those high-level small SUVs like a Seltos or an HR-V or a low-level CX-5 or RAV4.
Has Mitsubishi improved on the cabin MoCo?
Sort of. So the old one had a, similar to Lexus actually, it had this really fiddly infotainment system, which was a touchscreen, but also had a like laptop-style trackpad that the car encouraged you to use. And it wasn't particularly user-friendly, a bit like the Lexus systems. We found it to be not that intuitive. The new one does away with all that and replaces that with some storage area and actually just has a simple touchscreen with phone mirroring and obviously a reversing camera. Pretty basic system. It's one of those Nissan, Mitsubishi, Renault Alliance systems, which they're not exactly pushing the boundaries. They're very basic, but so long as you just use it for phone mirroring, it's okay. Other than that, look, its material quality and sort of the use of the different plastics and things throughout are very Mitsubishi. It does feel kind of built to a price. It's put together well, but not exactly a tactile masterpiece. Lots of shiny black plastics, lots of kind of, you know, tacky switches and blank points and things like that do kind of bring it down market just a bit. And it's also not particularly roomy up the front. The dashboard sort of bulges out at you and you do feel a bit hemmed in. So it is sort of mixed bag as far as it goes.
MoCo, I like the Alcantara-style seat inserts.
Yeah, that's a real highlight. And the cabin's not without its charms. Obviously, the seats are great. It's relatively comfortable. Driving position's nice and high, which is what you want from a car like that. And it's got one of the other things I quite like alongside the seats, Crawf, and I'm sure you've probably appreciated this, is I reckon Mitsubishi, before they decided to get rid of the Lancer Evo, must have ordered about a million sets of those metallic silver paddle shifters, because they fitted them to this car and they're fixed on the column just like a WRC car. I watch WRC all the time and they've got massive paddles stuck to the column. And it, just like that on an Eclipse Cross, it's kind of an interesting touch that's sort of lovable. But the seats are pretty nice, Crawf.
Yeah.
MoCo, when the Eclipse Cross first launched, one of the things that I think frustrated people was that it had this new turbo engine. It had the Eclipse badge on it. It looked quite interesting, but it didn't really deliver on the promise of being a new kind of flagshipy SUV for Mitsubishi. Does the update kind of give it a bit more sparkle and a bit more of a pitch as a premium alternative to the ASX, or does it still feel a little bit parts bin?
Well, in some ways it does feel a lot better to drive than its other SUVs, fellow Mitsubishi SUVs. First of all, that engine, as you say, Scully, 110 kilowatt, 250 newton meter, 1.5 litre turbo. And Mitsubishi has shown that it's actually capable of still making a really good engine. This is a fairly new design. It's the only Mitsubishi that's used in, but it's actually a great engine. Heaps of torque from low down, just off idle point, really strong muscular mid-range, quite refined. The CVT doesn't slur and encourage the engine to flare like a lot of them do, and you've got a manual override there. So really nice drivetrain. But look, the company claims to have tweaked the steering a bit and the suspension, but it's still very much a comfort-focused SUV. The steering's always very light and numb. There's quite pronounced body roll in corners, which is the trade-off for that really sort of plush, pliant ride. So in no way is it a sporty SUV, although I will caveat that by saying the one that I had was the front-wheel drive. You can get an all-wheel drive in other spec levels, which is Mitsubishi's great super all-wheel control system, which has, you know, your control and torque vectoring and sort of can really cleverly send the power front to rear. And Mitsubishi's got some real runs on the board with that system. So the all-wheel drive system would help quite a bit. But the one that I had, pretty sort of plain Jane to drive, to be honest with you.
And what about the plug-in hybrid? Do we know when that's going to be in Australia? Because that's quite exciting given it's a good system in the Outlander.
It really is. And so that's one of the great things. So not only is there going to be one globally, but Australia is going to be one of the first markets to get it. Mitsubishi has really pivoted to make Oceania a focus market worldwide. And the plug-in hybrid Eclipse Cross is expected in 2021, as far as I know. And that's basically using the current Outlander FEV system. There'll be a new Outlander next year with an even better FEV system. So they're sort of trickling down that technology to a cheaper option. If they can price that FEV Eclipse Cross sort of in the mid-40s, that's pretty compelling to me. It's a really good system. It's got that super all-wheel control. It's got the electric oomph. You know, the motors are doing a lot of the driving, so it's quite snappy off the mark. I reckon that could be a bit of a game changer. I'm not quite sold on the appeal of FEVs in Australia, but there's a growing demand for them, and it'll give Mitsubishi a real fillip. So that should be the performance leader.
Mike, it's got a bit of a tough sell with the CX-5 Max Sport, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, that was the, so I did that comparison test sort of almost as an opportunity. Wongy, it was actually James Wong who noticed that we had those cars concurrently and suggested it. And I said, mate, what are you talking about? You got rocks in your head. And then he actually worked me through the fact that this new one's grown by such a significant amount and has got new equipment that it actually on paper is essentially a dead-on rival for that Max Sport CX-5. Which kind of says that it's a pretty ambitious pitch from Mitsubishi, and you'd suspect they'll probably start to do some deals at some point. And it's by no means disgraced, though, you know, those swoopy looks do mean that it's not quite as practical inside as some competitor SUVs, as you'd expect. Mm. And, yeah, against a low-range CX-5, it's a pretty hard sell. But, you know, against something like a Honda HR-V, I think it's got some appeal. What do you guys think of the look, by the way? It's pretty polarizing. I'd be very curious to know what you think.
I like the front.
Mm.
It definitely
I'm glad
seems-
they got rid of the horizontal bar at the back.
It definitely seems like one of those cars that has its angles. I think in the photos, Mitsubishi's done a good job of shooting it, pointing slightly downwards on the perfect 45-degree angle at the front and the rear. And you look at some of the photos of the pre-update one and it was the same. It has some really attractive angles and interesting lines. I am curious to sit next to one in traffic though, because I think there might be quite an overhang at the back and I'm not sure about that.
Mm. See, this car really needs, so you can get a spec above the one that I had called the Exceed, and it has leather seats and a sunroof and a head-up display and that, you know, really good super all-wheel control, all-wheel drive system. If you could have that car for $39,990 drive away rather than sort of the you know, well above the 40 grand mark, you're starting to talk. And if, you know, if in sort of 6 months we start to see the Eclipse Cross Aspire going for sort of $32,990 rather than $36,000, that's when it becomes pretty compelling. Right now it's sort of priced alongside a lot of competitor products that are really, really good. I mean, a new generation Ford Escape with all the safety tech and 180-kilowatt motor costs the same as this Eclipse Cross. So, you know, it's got its work cut out for it. So I sort of feel as time goes by and the value equation improves, and we all know Mitsubishi does deals, that'll happen. One other real selling point of this car is Mitsubishi's after sales. So it's got pretty cheap servicing, $299 every service, and it's 15,000K or 12-month intervals, which is fantastic. Not quite Toyota cheap, but pretty much, you know, that sort of second level of service costs. Then the warranty, well, it's 5 years as standard, but if you keep servicing your Mitsubishi at a Mitsubishi dealer rather than going into the aftermarket, Mitsubishi will extend that warranty to 10 years or 200,000 Ks. So having a 10-year warranty in your back pocket, you kind of, that's a real fillip, I think, for the brand. And I noticed just recently the ACCC greenlit that plan. So that's another reason to maybe look at it.
That's pretty incredible, isn't it, that kind of peace of mind?
Yeah, it is. And, you know Mitsubishis aren't going to let you down. I mean, that's another appeal of the car. So, look, I think it's a decent update. It's definitely made it a better car than it was, less polarizing in design, a bit more tech. I'd try and nudge for the all-wheel drive one personally, and I'd probably wait a few months and pick up a demo or wait till a couple of deals emerge and, get that real Mitsubishi value equation right.
You have given the Eclipse Cross Aspire a 7.6 Car Expert rating. You can read that review now live. Mike Costello, thank you.
Thank you. And, guys, thank you all for your year. Mandy, it's been brilliant doing the pod all year with you. And, hopefully you have a lovely break.
We already know how terrible 2020 was, and it's fair to say we are looking forward to seeing the back of it. But we will also be seeing the rear bumper of many car models in Australia for the last time as this year draws to a close. So William Stopford has made a list of discontinued models that will no longer be here in Australia for 2020, and he joins us now to tell us about them. Hello, Will.
Hey, Mandy. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. What was the biggest surprise and not so biggest surprise model that's going out this year?
I mean, it's a bloody long list. I can't remember just how many are on there.
I think it's about 27 cars, Will, from memory. It's a decent number.
Does that include the entire Holden brand and the entire Infiniti brand?
No, that doesn't. So, yeah. let's add a fair few more to that.
And you know what? Just before I came on to do the podcast, I read your article today, Scott, on Hyundai actually discontinuing the Veloster. So it seems like there could still be some more victims by year's end. But it's kind of a mix of perhaps surprising discontinuations and others that we saw coming. Things like the Bentley Mulsanne and the Aston Martin Rapide and the Alfa Romeo Giulietta have been around for about, you know, a decade. So we knew that they were eventually going to call time on that. But there were some surprise discontinuations as well. The Veloster, for example, the i30 Fastback N. And of course, I think we knew that Holden was, you know, teetering on the brink there, but for the entire brand to shut down early this year, that definitely caught me by surprise. I thought they'd give it a few more years yet. So that's an entire brand's worth of models as well that's joined the list. So it is a very long list, and I also put it to the team as to what cars they are going to miss the most that were discontinued this year. So that's another article that you should definitely check out on carexpert.com.au.
I think one of the common ones that the team chose was the BMW i8. Was that a surprise to you as well?
No, look, I mean, on the list there are some cars that I'm not going to say we won't miss, because I do love variety, and I think that's one of the best things about the Australian car market is that we've just got an extraordinary variety of brands, of models, etc. Even if we do grumble sometimes that we don't get enough plug-in hybrids or we don't get enough cars that are made for left-hand drive only, etc. But for many years I wrote for a website called Curbside Classic, which really celebrated obscure finds. We'd take photos of cars we saw on the street, and then you'd write up an article about it about 10 or 15 years after the car was made, and people would go, or even longer, and people would go, oh, I can't even remember the last time I saw one of those. And I think there are some cars on this list, like the i30 Fastback, for example, or the Ford Focus Wagon, which have had such a short run in Australia that some of us will probably just forget they even sold them here until we see one parked on the street years from now. And you're like, oh, that's right, they sold a Focus Wagon here. And also, fun fact, took us four generations of Focus for us to finally get the wagon. They sold it for about 2 years and they discontinued it. So can't sell wagons here.
We've already spoken previously in the podcast about sedans are on the nose now, but I'm a little bit sad that the Ford Mondeo and the Kia Optima are also on the way out as well, Will.
Yeah, you sound like J-Wo. He said the same thing. And look, I agree. I do love that class of car. And the Mondeo is just one of the saddest cases on this because, a lot of the cars that were discontinued this year, Ferrari GTC4, Lusso, et cetera, they're low-volume cars. But the Mondeo is one of those cars where Ford has sold it here for, three generations. Oh, we missed one generation. And it just never seemed to get that much traction. Even though every single generation, it was fundamentally a good car. It is just one of those cars that just doesn't get any respect. So it is really sad to see that go. There are some cars on this list that are also ending production just in general. So things like the Mulsanne and the Fiat 124 Spider, that looks like it doesn't have much time left because they don't even sell it in Europe anymore. But the Mondeo is one of those cars where its future isn't even assured because people don't like larger sedans here. Oh, they don't like them in Europe. They've discontinued the related Fusion in North America. So there's rumors that the next Mondeo will morph into just like a crossover kind of wagon. Same thing with the defunct Holden Commodore, formerly known as also known as the Opel Insignia. That may also morph into a crossover as well. So it is a segment that's being hollowed out. When you look at the sales figures, the Toyota Camry accounts for about, 2/3 of the midsize under $60,000 segment. And it's a shrinking segment, but, good luck challenging the Camry. Good luck challenging Toyota in a lot of segments, really. And also another car that was on the list, I believe we actually were the first to report this, the Honda NSX, sadly, is no longer with us. So that was disproportionately the most expensive car in Honda showrooms, and they sold Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, they sold 9 of them.
I think it's 9, yeah.
Over the past few years. That will still continue to be on sale in other markets, such as in the US where it's sold as an Acura NSX. But sadly, not going to be available here anymore. And other cars as well, like the Jeep Renegade that does pretty decently in Europe, won't be sold here anymore. So it is a very interesting list. It is a very varied list. I look forward to writing next year's list. But definitely check it out on the website. It is worth the read. I shouldn't be saying that about my own article. Somebody else say it's worth the read.
You know what? It is definitely worth the read.
There we go.
Some time on Christmas morning, consider it.
Yes.
There's also another article which is well worth reading is each member of the Car Expert team picked the one that they're going to miss as well. So that's a separate story. William Stopford, hey, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and we'll speak to you in 2021.
You too, everybody. Take care. Happy holidays.
That puts an end to the last Car Expert podcast for 2020. Scully, what car have you got over the Christmas break?
I'm actually driving an Alfa Romeo Giulia Veloce, the updated car. It's finished in alpha red with beautiful sort of gunmetal grey telephone dial wheels. It is stunning. It also drives really nicely in my brief experience of it so far. So looking forward to getting some miles behind the wheel. Also got the keys to a Skoda Kamiq. So I haven't driven that or the T-Cross yet. So that'll also be very interesting.
Cool. What have you got, Croft?
Quite the collection. I am getting into tomorrow a new Defender 110 P400 SE. And
nice.
Restrictions permitting, I'll be driving that to my mother's on the border, the New South Wales side of the Queensland border.
Let's hope you're going to be able to see your family over Christmas, Croft.
Too right.
And you can go for a decent drive. I'm assuming we've got plenty of Christmas content coming up, Scully.
We do, but something we don't usually do. We're going to leave you on a cliffhanger this year. We've got all sorts of content about the favourite cars we've driven, the biggest automotive trends that need to go and die in a hole next year, the cars we're most looking forward to next year. I know, Croft, yours is the 911 GT3, but
yeah.
Rather than give all of our answers and the good content away, you're just going to have to tune in, and there'll be one of those live every morning along with the good news content that we're doing and also a fresh review every day.
Awesome stuff. And as always, we'd love to hear from you, podcast at carexpert.com.au. We wish you all, on behalf of the Car Expert team, a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And thank you so much for listening, Scott Colley and Tony Crawford. Thank you so much for a great year.
Merry Christmas, Mandy. Thank you.
Thanks, Mandy.